Let me begin by welcoming you all to the Danilo Husar-Strug Memorial Lecture. In particular, I would like to welcome members of Danilo Strug's family, his widow, his mother, his sister. Thank you for coming. This is the fifth in an annual series of lectures sponsored by the Danilo Husar-Strug Program in Ukrainian Literature of the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies. The program was created shortly after Danilo's death in order to promote the study of Ukrainian literature in the English-speaking world. The program, with its rather modest resources, has pursued three very specific and limited goals. The first is this annual lecture series, which we take as our sacred obligation and our most significant activity. The second has been the sponsorship of the Electronic Library of Ukrainian Literature on the Internet. And our third area of activity, modest so far, is to stimulate translations of literary works and other source material for the study of Ukrainian literature into English. This lecture series honors the memory of Danilo Husar-Strug, who was a professor of Ukrainian literature here at the University of Toronto. Those of us who knew Danilo, and I'm very proud to have been a friend and a colleague of his, we knew him as a man of many interests and many skills. He's best known, of course, as the indefatigable editor of the Encyclopedia of Ukraine, a project that he essentially completed in his lifetime, but that lives on in its new home on the internet. He was also a great champion of scholarly projects and organizational activities. As associate director of CIUS, as president and long active member of the Canadian Association of Slavists, as the director of the European branch of the Shevchenko Scientific Society, and through his participation in many organized activities and forums, he played a role in one way or another in a great deal of the scholarly activity in Ukrainian studies that occurred in his lifetime. On the personal side, he was a man of passionate tastes in any number of areas, including poetry, which he both read and wrote, wine, music, travel, and a great many other things. But he was also a dedicated scholar and a teacher. The activity that most clearly defined his life's work was the promotion of Ukrainian literature to students, to readers, to anyone who would listen. It is in that capacity in particular that this series honors his memory by providing a forum in which Ukrainian literature, broadly conceived, is discussed in a public scholarly lecture. On this, the fifth year of our lecture series, it's particularly appropriate to have as our speaker Professor Taras Koznarski of the University of Toronto. Professor Koznarski is in the position that was left vacant by Professor Strug's untimely death. Professor Koznarski is a little bit of the best of both worlds, both Ukraine and our Western Ukrainian scholarly tradition. He was born, of course, in Ukraine and began his education there. He graduated from Lviv University and thereafter entered the Institute of Literature of the Ukrainian Academy of Science, but in a fortunate accident of history, Ukrainian independence rescued him from his fate at the Institute of Literature, and he came west, and indeed, he actually first arrived in a scholarly capacity here in Canada and did his MA at the University of Alberta, and then proceeded to Harvard University, where he did his doctorate in Slavic literatures, producing a dissertation on the shaping of Ukrainian cultural identity, Kharkiv literary almanacs in the 1830s. Professor Kuznarski has been here at the University of Toronto since the year 2000, and we are very happy to welcome him to give today's talk, Kyiv in Myth and Imagination.
Thank you very much. It is truly an honor to be invited to deliver a lecture named after Danila Ozov-Stuk. Danila Stuk had a great impact on his colleagues and students, and his works will continue to have to inspire scholars, especially in Ukrainian studies. Again, thank you very much for inviting me. Today, I would like to share some of my experiences in examining literary Kyiv and some of the problems that accompany the study of this remarkable city. In recent years, we find a number of explorations of the myths, quote unquote, or texts of certain cities, of Petersburg in particular. We can only mention the names of Tvorov and Clark. I will be using the term Kievan text or Kievan myth. What do I mean by this term? I mean a narrative, or rather a conglomerate of narratives connected by a number of themes, events, and heroes that have a symbolic meaning and resonance. These narratives, found in legends, historiography, and literary works, for example, focus on fundamental, dramatic, existential moments, the issues of origin and predestination, the interaction between the city and its environment and country, miraculous transformations, and tremendous catastrophes. All of those, of course, happened in Kyiv. The Kievan text has over the centuries encompassed both the familiar image of the city as a God-protected, golden-domed capital of great princes, martyrs, and monks that comes down to us from medieval texts, as well as a site where dark forces roam unchecked. I will be looking at the interplay between these extremes, first through an overview of the most important old sources of the Kievan glorious text, followed by an examination of the mapping of Kyiv in two works that expand this repertoire of demonic images and themes associated with the city. The text of Kyiv has a long and illustrious history. From the earliest Rus texts from the 11th and 12th centuries, such as Primary Chronicle, the Sermon on Law and Grace by Metropolitan Hilarion, and the Memorial and Encomium for Prince Vladimir, Kyiv is defined as central to the political, ideological, religious, and cultural destiny of Rus. The Primary Chronicle, for example, weaves together a number of legends that elaborate the origins of Kyiv. The first of them, the apocryphal story of the Apostle Andrew traveling along the Dnipro River, borrowing, that legend is borrowed from the writing of Eusebius of Caesarea, highlights the providential origin of the city. In the words of the Apostle, I quote, "See these hills, so shall the favor of God shine upon them, that on this spot a great city shall arise, and God shall erect many churches therein." A second tale on Kyiv's secular origins comes from a local legend, either local or borrowed, it's not entirely clear, about the three brothers, Kishchek and Khoriv, and their sister Lyubich, who built the city and named it after the older brother. The first story of origin firmly locates the city within the overarching framework of sacred history. The second provides an etymological explanation, as we often find in medieval texts, Krak, founder of Krakow, and so on, and sets the city in the local time immemorial, the legendary time. The third thread of the origin is, of course, dynastic. The Primary Chronicle describes how Varangian rulers became rulers of the city upon the invitation of the local Polyanian tribes. And finally, the fourth spiritual origin of the city is connected with the mass baptism of Kyiv as the renewal of the city, after which it is called New Jerusalem, which refers, of course, both to Jerusalem itself and to the notion of Constantinople, which had one of its attributes, the new or the second Jerusalem. Hence, the Primary Chronicle brings together in a rather comprehensive manner the providential, etymological, dynastic, and spiritual issues of the origins of Kyiv. I'll turn now to the memorial and encomium for Volodymyr, a text geared toward the posthumous promotion of the Grand Prince to sainthood in the late 13th century. In this text, we find further components of Kyiv's special status and destiny. I quote, "Oh, the miracle! Kyiv appeared at the second Jerusalem, and Volodymyr appeared as the second Moses. There in Jerusalem, there was the true religion, which renounces idolatry. And here now is a pure faith in the holy baptism that leads unto eternal life." End of quote. This passage not only connects Kyiv to Jerusalem, but again, as in Primary Chronicle, to Constantinople. And this remarkable set of parallels clearly indicates healthy imperial appetites of the Kievan political and religious elites. Now, I'll probably show you a couple of images which reflect the ancient history of Kyiv. They are both reconstructed, the ones that are preserved still now, and some of them are recently rebuilt. So this is one of the panoramas. There are several of them. And this is Vladimir's city, where you can see that if you believe some of the travelers, Kyiv at that point, or between Vladimir and Yaroslav, might have as many as 400 churches. I don't know how you can really count 400 churches there, but there are plenty of golden domes already present in the city. And this is a reconstruction that allows us to have some visual image of the city. Of course, this visual image was not available to many generations of Kievites after the decline and destruction of the city, beginning from the late 12th century. This is a reconstruction of the famous Golden Gate. Among the interesting recent tokens to the origins of Kyiv is this strange-looking stone upon which we can read the beginning of the Primary Chronicle, "Откуда есть пошла русская земля?" It's not too far from the History Museum. Not that it actually came from that spot, but it's one of the tokens of historic memory that is popular with Kyivites today. And finally, this is one of the statues that surrounds Princess Olga in Mikhailivsky Square. It's a reconstruction of the late 19th century monument. And here we see a very iconic image of St. Andrew showing, pointing to those hills upon which the gods raised the rest. The images of Kievan glory contributed to shaping of Russian imperial history in the 18th and early 19th century. It contributed to many histories, was appropriated in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. There were many ways of sharing legacies and claiming them, beginning pretty much from the 13th century on. But the Kievan origins, Kievan glory, becomes, with help of Ukrainians, of course, just to name Innocentii Izil, very quickly incorporated into the Russian imperial history from the late 17th century on and through the 18th century. In the Russian imperial context, Kyiv is commonly characterized as a pure source of Russian orthodoxy, the ancient roots of Russian nationality, and the crib of Russian autocracy. You look at any component of the Russian Empire, you might find it located in Kyiv. Of the various attributes and parallels between Kyiv and the great cities of the past that we find in medieval texts, being Rome, Constantinople, Jerusalem, it is the second Jerusalem notion that turns out to be the most lasting and definitive. The 19th century saw the remarkable growth of the Kievan text, or conglomerate of texts. Among the work memorializing or mythologizing or exploring Kyiv, there were a number of genres, number of texts, and literary fashions, from sentimentalist travelogues, panegyric and narrative poems, legends, tales, and novels by authors including Ismailov, Narizhny, Kozlov, Bestuzhev, and many others. Most of this corpus of literary works comes from the late 1820s and 1830s, years critical to the search for the contours of a Russian culture and national identity in which the so-called Ukrainian fashion played an important role. A peculiarity of Romanticist Kyiv, and to some degree its uniqueness and uniqueness of Kievan myth in general, is that the depiction and topographies of the cities are often produced on the level of imagination, either based on generic stereotypes or descriptions of Kievan events in histories, chronicles, legends, and anecdotes. It would be untenable to write a novel, for example, on the time of troubles without knowing Moscow well. Not so when dealing with Kyiv, with its more ancient times. Kyiv, in the 19th century, especially in the early decades, was an elusive city, existing more in the imagination based on traces of past glory than on the contemporary urban reality, which wasn't particularly impressive. In the first decades of the 19th century, Kyiv was a relatively small town with about 30,000 inhabitants and influx of about 100,000 a year of pilgrims. It is rather described by travelers to the city as a number of sites and settlements such as Pechersk, High City, Kodil, that were rather poorly connected. It was much less impressive in urban terms than, for example, the younger Kharkiv. Thus, one's imagination could roam freely and fill in the gaps where necessary. And we see some of the iconography of Kyiv in the first half of the 19th century as a strange combination of buildings and within a peculiar rural setting. And one of the most interesting images produced about Kyiv at that time was, of course, Shevchenko. We'll look at a couple of these images. I'll start actually not with Shevchenko, but with another artist, Sazhen, who painted use of Kyiv in the 1840s. And I apologize for this crease, but this is called Переправа. As you see, it's a view of Kyiv somewhere far on the hill, and those travelers who are moving along the bank of Dnipro are standing in some kind of wonder, driven to its golden domes. This is also Sazhen, the view of Podil. And we can notice here how churches and some historic buildings are betwixt with rural, peasantly small houses and huts. This is Shevchenko's Аскольдова Могила. Again, it's a little, Kyiv is a very peculiar place that has gaps, that does not have a sense of urban continuity which you find in other cities due to its history. And Kyiv only develops certain level of urban continuity that the city is bound together from 1860s on. And here we just see sites on the pastoral rural, against the pastoral rural background. This is his Old Saints Lavra, which is particularly interesting in terms of these disconnected gazes of passers-by who are engaged in their own dreaming or imagining of the past and their own agendas. And of course we see the this on a rather small scale, but we see the level of a certain social scope of these buildings. You clearly see the peasant coming here, and a local or visiting noble lady. And of course, a beggar here in the corner, a fixture of any grand monastery. This is one of the very interesting works by Shevchenko that has two versions. It's called In Kiev from 1844. And if you try to see Kiev there, you'll be quite puzzled. But this is Shevchenko's Kiev. Shevchenko is very anti-urban in his treatment of communities and histories. For him, of course, Petersburg would be the epitomization of this evil urban space. And he is not looking particularly for urban spaces in Kiev. For him, it's the morning when the pilgrims or visitors are tidy themselves up, wash themselves, and also the image, which is not very clear here, a little bit dark, of old men. In another version, he is sitting near a crib. So this peaceful moment of making, getting ready to go to the following monastery or church that we find in Chechen. And very intimate sense of Kiev and very rural, pastoral. And this Kiev view, again, we see this, the attention of Shevchenko is drawn to the tree, to this phenomenon of natural world. But behind it, we can see some golden domes, some historic monuments, some churches. Within the orbit of Romantic literature, Kiev was uniquely attractive, not only for its ancient spirituality, but also for its eschatological dimension. Thus, not only is Kiev the source, the root, the crib, and so on, but also an ancient battlefield of the forces of good and evil. For an adventurous literary explorer of history, Kiev offered not only cathedrals, monasteries, and meek monks, but a unique territory where the pagan past of the Slavs could be effectively enacted. As we read in a primary chronicle, after Volodymyr's conversion of the Kievites, and I quote, "There was joy in heaven and upon earth, but the devil groaned, lamenting, 'Woe is me! How am I driven out hence? For I thought my dwelling place is here, since the apostolic teachings did not abide in this land. Nor did this people know God, but I rejoiced in the service they rendered unto me. But now my reign in these regions is at an end.'" Yet it wasn't the end, of course. The presence of primevals, ancient Slavic gods, idols, sacrifices, intrigues, and deeds had great imaginative appeal. Prokopovich's tragicomedy Volodymyr from 1705 describes the battle of pagan and Christian forces in Kiev, although, of course, in more allegorical terms. The demonic side to Kievan history and the notion of evil forces roaming on the outskirts of the city is explored by a number of writers. There is Pushkin's tongue-in-cheek ballad Husar, treating pretty much every woman in Kiev as a potential witch, but it's very tongue-in-cheek. Pushkin's pretty much every ballad is a parody of something, including his very famous Chornaya Shal, the Black Shawl, which is also a very parodic text. There's Boris Somov, Kharkovite, who ended up in the capital. He wrote tale The Kievan Witches, probably the first literary text which sets the standards for descriptions of the phenomena of Kievan witches with their capital at the Bald Mountain, as you know. And there is Gogol's Kiev, where on the outskirts of the city, evil forces roam unchecked. I mean here the Terrible Revenge, but as well his longer tale V. In the mid-1830s, toward the end of the Romantic fashion, two novels were produced that focused on the dramatic events of the times of Volodymyr the Great. Both enjoyed popularity and both operated entirely within an imagined city. And pretty much all Romantic writers, including Hrebinka, including Gogol, who had infatuation with Kiev and planned to go there and buy a house. He was begging Maximovich to do all these real estate arrangements for him in Kiev. He didn't have any idea what Kiev looks like. It was purely in his imagination that he decided that this is going to be his spiritual Jerusalem and he has to be there. Once he's been there, the theme of Kiev vanishes from his writing and he puts his Jerusalem somewhere else, moving to Rome and then visiting actual Jerusalem in the 40s. The renowned Russian author of historical novels, Mikhail Zagoskin, published his Askold's Grave in 1833, and it later, you might recall, it became a famous opera, a popular opera by Verstovsky. This novel describes the failed attempt by the descendants of the legendary Askold, who was killed by Rurik, to assassinate Vladimir on the very outset of his decision to convert. The second work, which I'll focus on, was published in 1835, and it is a folkloric Gothic novel by Alexander Veltman, entitled Svetoslavich, or Son of Svetoslav, Prince Svetoslav, the Foster Child of Evil Forces. It sounds very long, but in Russian it's very short. Svetoslavich, Vrazhi Pitomets. Vrag here means evil, and I'll explain why. Both novels try to solve the ethical problem of Saint Vladimir the Great, prince and saint. His actions and characteristics before conversion included fratricide, rape, reckless cruelty, and uncontrollable lust, after all, on the one hand, and the charitable, meek, indeed ideal qualities of ideal ruler as represented in the primary chronicle and hagiography on the other, after conversion. Veltman proposed a fantastic slash folkloric solution to the moral and psychological problem of Vladimir. He split the prince into two creatures. The real Vladimir, the beautiful son Vladimir, as we know from epic songs, endowed with goodness and moral strength. The second creature is one of the Russian favorite folkloric creatures called Kikimora. It's a baby stolen from Princess Inegilda, who is treated as Svetoslav's wife, and it's stolen from her womb because during an argument Svetoslav cursed her baby, and that was enough to do the magic. The stolen baby raised by the forest spirits looks exactly like Vladimir, and hence the ensuing confusion. But in his moral development remains a child. While a retelling of the miraculous reversals, traversals, and love triangles would take too much of our time, I will now turn to Veltman's Kiev as the setting for events based on his study of various chronicles. They seem fantastic, but actually we can read, and commentary indicates that he actually did examine a lot of written sources, travel accounts, before writing his descriptions, imaginary descriptions of Kiev and Kievan Rus. In Svetoslavich, the configuration of the imaginary Kievan space goes far beyond conventional and nondescript hills with orchards and golden domes with a mighty river below. Rather, it provides details of buildings, rooms, the overall location of sites within the limits of Kiev, and descriptions of territories adjacent to the city. The genesis of Kiev as a universal capital of demonic forces is thus explained. From the times of Constantine the Great, the demons settle on Bald Mountain, choosing later a better hill, the densely forested mountain of Tor that dominated the Dnipro River. Near the grave mound of the Scythian kings, the capital of the demons, vampires, witches, and mermaids was established. There, the pagan Slavs erected an idol to Terror. So this is his genesis, a story of Kiev, or Kievan Hill, as the capital of evil forces, the demonic forces. However, the Apostle Andrew drew the evil forces away from the hill on which Princess Olga later built her golden roofed palace. A detailed description of the hills, ravines, and rivers of Kiev follows. The author ends with a paean to the city treated as a pastoral rather than urban city. I quote, "Beautiful was Kiev. The ancestor said, repentance won't help those who never visited Kiev. Kiev is the gate of heaven, they said. There the Dnipro is bright, the banks of the river are mysterious and holy. The hills are tall and green, and the air pure. Come and bow to Kiev, the descendants of the Scythians. There is nothing more ancient than its holy sites, nothing holier than its antiquity. The mystery remains imperishable, but its veil is transient. Come, descendants of the Scythians, bow to Kiev. There you'll find the contemporaries of Darius, Mitridat, and Attila. This text offers valuable insights into the process of constructing an imaginary ancient Kievan topography as the site where good Christian forces coexist with an environs occupied by evil spirits. Bethmann's text, along with Zagoskin, mark the end of the romantic literary exploration of Kiev's ancient topography. From the 1840s, when the so-called natural school becomes the dominant literary force, Kiev is pushed to the margin of the Russian imperial literary projects. It is at this time that the city is picked up by Ukrainian intellectuals who try to locate it within the providential and historic framework of Ukrainian history, by no means an easy task. From Kostomarov and Shevchenko to Kulish and later Natchul Levitsky, Ukrainian writers and intellectuals tackle and appropriate the elusive city into the Ukrainian cultural space. And this was a topic of a lecture I gave this year, so if necessary, I'll leave it for discussion, but I'll move on to the early 20th century, where we find another demonic incarnation of Kiev. In the 20th century, we find the new wave of Kievan texts that include this demonic component. We also find a number of remarkable texts that further explore the myth of Kiev in the contemporary setting, not ancient setting, yet with clear links to the 19th century projects and even earlier traditions. There were three novels that are particularly fascinating that emerged within the two decades between 1908 and 1927. Their authors have different Kievan backgrounds, different agendas, and literary styles. All three works, however, are set in Kiev, and all three do not refer to the city directly. Kiev referred to as Gorod and Misto, a city or the city, and is used for different purposes, some of which I'll address shortly. Before I'll discuss the first novel in this row of texts, I'd like us to take a look at some of the images of the turn of the century Kiev. And at that point, of course, it's not that 30,000 people, but a quarter of a million people city, and quickly growing. At the turn of the century, 1897, that would be almost a quarter of a million. And in about 17 more years, that would be 468,000 people. So Kiev experiences a dramatic urban growth starting from 1860s. This is city council on that used to be on Khreshchatyk. This is Khreshchatyk itself, early 20th century, the street that made many Kievites proud, and they called it our Neva Prospect, rivaling Petersburg. This is Veliko Volodymyrska Street, named after great Prince Vladimir. And we see here the advancement, the further advancement of civilization, the pride of Kievites, the electric streetcar. This is one of the iconic images of Lavra, with visitors of various social backgrounds. And also in Kiev, at the turn of the century, we see the clear demonstration that growth is being accumulated in the city and is being properly displayed. Buildings like this, the facade of buildings like this would probably cost three times more than the rest of the building. And some of the old photographs capture the so-called contraste, the encounters or non-encounters between different people. And it still remains an alienating force, as you see in this photograph. The three novels I mentioned are Alexander Kuprin's The Pit or Yama, Mikhail Bulgakov's The White Guard, and Valerian Pitmahilny's The City. Each of these novels relates to and engages in its own peculiar way with the Kievan text, that conglomerate of narratives and themes discussed earlier. And each reflects an absolutely different historic Kiev as well. The Pit describes the city before the revolutionary events of 1905. The White Guard tells of the highly charged experience of the Kievite family in 1918, the year that saw a number of regimes, attacks, and pogroms roll over the city. And finally, Pitmohilny, the city deals with the experience of a young ambitious villager who comes to the city to study in the 1920s during the new economic policy, the politics of the so-called colonization and Ukrainian cultural revival. With the time left, I will focus on Alexander Kuprin's The Pit, Yama, published in several installments between 1908 and 1915. The author uses the novel to explore the phenomenon of prostitution. It's one of those dramatic, showy pieces of writing. It explores the social and moral origins, conditions, and institutions of this phenomenon. In 1894, after aborted military career, Kuprin had arrived in Kiev in search of work and soon embarked on a career as a writer or journalist. This by no means was easy, and he started by earning 1.5 to 2 kopecks a line in the local newspapers. Yet this journalistic slavery expanded the scope of his experience, social experiences, and provided him with themes and ideas that he realized later in his writing, including material on the city's underworld explored in this novel, The Pit. It did make a splash. It was reviewed, discussed, and argued about. The reviews ranged from accusation of pornography to the recognition of the critical, moral, and social thrust of the work. It was translated into a number of languages. The English translation was published in 1927 in the United States. At the center of the work is a description of the everyday life in a mid-level brothel of the outskirts of Kiev, the Kievan Red Light District, Yamskaya Street. Now, if there are Kievites among you, you'll probably recognize some of this topography. The street is real and it exists now, which is renamed. The Yamskaya Street is back. Actually, I'll start with the center of Kiev. So Yamskaya Street would be right here, and that would be certainly outskirts of the city in the 1890s. But now, of course, it's a different story. So if you know this part of Kiev, if you've been there, Yamska is going to be, try to show it with the cursor. So here is Yamska. As you see today, it's flanked by Ulitsa Ivana Fedorova, the printer of the East Slavs, and Ulitsa Telmana, the great German communist. At the turn of the century, this area looked approximately like this. This is Novoe Strayenie, so it's a mishmash conglomerate of buildings or houses with little plots of land. Certainly not yet a street like Chervonarmeyska that we see it today. As I said, at the center of this novel, The Pit, we find a mid-level brothel. It is depicted as a peculiar sisterhood of women kept in the brothel, and it is examined through their encounters with clients of various ages, appearances, and social strata, ranging from university students to their professors, from criminal elements to bureaucrats. The text, which is prefaced with the author's dedication to mothers and youth, has as its purpose to condemn the terrifying normalcy of prostitution in a society that generates demand for fallen women. The novel is thus rather didactic in its social stance, and conventional or obvious in its handling of the plot and characters. The brothel in The Pit is a kind of anti-monastery, a monastery turned inside out. The nocturnal life of the brothel is secluded, yet accessible for outsiders, and is dominated by tedious, boring, exhausting labor. The women are ruthlessly exploited by the owner, Anna Markovna, and her economica, business officer, Emma Eduardovna. The prostitutes, who come from a range of social and ethnic backgrounds, have no chance of breaking out of the vicious cycle of debt to rehabilitate themselves in the normal world. Their only salvation and the inevitable conclusion of their lives is death through illness, suicide, or murder, or mental institution, as happens in this particular establishment. The attempt to save and rehabilitate one such woman, Lyubka, by a progressively minded university student, Lihonin, who has neither the means nor moral stamina for such an experiment, ends with his disillusionment and inability to turn Lyubka into his equal partner. In the end, she has to return to the brothel where she is penalized for her transgression. Zhenka, another character, comes closest to the notion of a protagonist. She is a strong and intelligent woman who, upon realizing that she is syphilis, undertakes the mission of infecting her clients, exploiters, as an act of revenge and revolt against her fate. Toward the end of the novel, she hangs herself as the illness becomes impossible to hide from routine medical exam conducted in the brothel by a doctor. The stories of the prostitutes highlight the injustice and duplicity of the social and moral order, and Kuprin highlights how the underground world is mirrored in the normal world, in the normal one. The prostitutes, with their naked and cruel truth, turn out to be superior to those in the normal world who hide their perversions behind facades of social conventions. By making the locus of his work a brothel, Kuprin produced not so much a novel, but rather a set of lives with a purpose, the lives of prostitutes. I would put it in more bluntly, it's a semi-journalistic patericon of the brothel with the purpose of imploring readers, mothers, and youth to take these set examples to heart. Kuprin denied that his novel was documentary in nature. He said in an interview, I quote, "The Pit is Odessa and Petersburg and Kiev," end quote. Yet however typical and universal he meant his novel to be, Kiev is entrenched firmly in the text, beyond the biographical circumstances of Kuprin's residence there. The very structure of the work, along with its didactic aims, uncannily imitate, if not unwillingly parody, the genre of the patericon. In depicting Kiev as a city of seedy streets and brothels, he creates a sharp contrast with the traditional image of the elevated, ancient, immutable, sacred, and golden dome Kiev of churches and monasteries, humble martyrs, ascetic monks, miracles, and divine grace. I must add here that this imitation is not textual. You cannot find links between the fates of specific prostitutes and the stories of the patericon. Rather, the parallels are structural and ideological through Kuprin's emulation of a didactic discourse. As a fictional locus, Kuprin's Kiev is the opposition of the God-protected Kiev, the second Jerusalem, the pure source of orthodoxy. It is, on the contrary, a locus where immorality permeates the entire fabric of society. Evil has no reason to lament here, as we read in the primary chronicle, but resides and is worshipped. While the main action and the perspectives of the novel revolves around the limited space of the brothel, Kuprin also provides a number of descriptive overviews of the larger setting of the city where events take place. Interestingly, these sections are few yet very extensive, as if the writer at certain points decides to give his reader a comprehensive tour to explain the rise or fall of the red light district, Yamskaya Street. As I mentioned, the novel opens with a tale of the origins of this area. I quote, "A long, long time ago, long before the railroads, the stagecoach drivers used to live from generation to generation at the very farthest confines of a large southern city," and this is the way he refers to Kiev. "That entire area was called Yamskaya Sloboda, or Yama, the pit. Over time, when hauling by steam killed off transportation by horses, the meddlesome tribe of the stage drivers little by little lost its boisterous ways and its brave customs, went over into other occupations, fell apart and scattered." Sounds almost like Scythians or Sarmatians. Again, quite uncannily, I don't think he does it on purpose. "There began to spring up brothels," continues Katrin, "permitted by the authorities, regulated by official supervision, and subject to strict rules. Toward the end of the 19th century, both streets of Yama, Great Yamskaya and Little Yamskaya, proved to be entirely occupied on one side of the street as well on the other, exclusively with houses of dimensions, opposed to the conventional pilgrimage as an ascent to holy churches and sites. On the contrary, the locus of action and gravity to which the inhabitants of the city are drawn is a pit, a lowly outskirt, and the depiction of the multitudinous crowd of customers acquires a sense of possession, an nocturnal anti-pilgrimage." I quote, "Till the very morning, hundreds and thousands of men ascend and descend these staircases. Here everybody frequents half-shattered ancients seeking artificial excitements, and boys, military cadets, and high school vets, almost children. Bearded paterfamilias, honorable pillars of society in golden spectacles, enamored bridegrooms, and honorable professors with renowned names, and thieves, and murderers, and liberal lawyers, clear-eyed, handsome fellows, and monsters maliciously distorted by nature, deaf mutes, blind men, men without noses, with flabby, pendulous bodies, old, trembling, covered with parasites, hot-bellied, hemorrhoidal aches. They come freely and simply, as to a restaurant. They sit, smoke, drink, convulsively pretend to be merry. So passes the entire night. Toward daybreak, Yama grows quiet, and the bright morning finds its depopulated, plunged into sleep." End of quote. This section could have been worthy of Andruchovich almost, if it weren't for its earnestness. I would go in further here. The best of moral intentions occasionally play tricks on writers. While aiming at precision and comprehensiveness of journalistic truth, Kuprin, with his oversized list, of which I only read an excerpt, arrives at the grotesque. Even if Kuprin would have explained that this is a generic episode, not specific to any city, we know the action takes place in Kiev, and the anti-sacredness of this description conjures up the notion of apocalypse enacted in space, which by tradition or myth is guarded by heavenly forces, beacons of light and faith. In so many words, we have an image of an anti-Kiev. In terms of placing Kiev on the geographic map, Kuprin also succeeds in a reverse extolling of the attractions of the languorous south. In a conversation between a pimp and an officer who decides to stop in the city on his way to Moscow, the former makes the following parallels to other cities that highlight the role and attributes of Kiev. I quote, "Remarkable city. An entirely European city. If you only knew what kinds of streets it has, electricity, streetcars, theaters. And if you only knew what kind of cafes, I urge you, go to Chateau de Fleurs, Tivoli, and go to the island. This is something special. And women, what women? It is truly remarkable that neither in Paris nor in London will you find such sophisticated ways of pleasing a man as in this city." In short, this is a secular version of the repertory of Kievan attributes, no longer the Second Jerusalem and the New Rome with their ideal and apostolic rulers. In Kuprin, Kiev at the turn of the 19th century is linked not with the glorious spiritual and political centers and agents of the past, but with the Western metropolis known for their moral problems and underworlds, as explored in literature, for example, by Eugene Sue and Charles Dickens. Finally, it is the eschatological action that brings the necessary closure to the Kievan pit, and it is caused by two factors: encroaching civilization and urbanization, and the massive celebration of the millennium of the Lavra itself, further emphasizing the mirroring effect of the novel depicted with religious writings in Kiev. Again, as in the opening of the novel, this detailed summary is striking in its sheer volume. It makes up an entire six-page chapter. I will allow myself to read several quotations and summarize the rest of the chapter. I quote, "As members of society die, go insane, are caught thieving, shoot or hang themselves, vacancy after vacancy is freed, promotions follow promotions, new elements flow in, and behold, after 2 years, everyone and everything is new, if only the institution has not fallen into pieces completely, has not fell apart. And is it not the same astounding destiny which overtakes enormous social, universal organizations, cities, empires, nations, countries, and who knows, perhaps all planetary worlds? Something resembling this incomprehensible fate swept over Yamskaya Street as well, bringing it to a rapid and scandalous destruction. The first subterranean shocks of the impending catastrophe were connected with the rapid industrial growth and urban boom in Kiev, as Kuprin explains. In addition, I quote, the city was at this time celebrating the millennial anniversary of its famous abbey, the Chersky Lavra here, the most honored and the richest among all the monasteries of the Russian Empire. From all the ends of Russia, out of Siberia, from the shores of the frozen ocean, from the extreme south, the Black and Caspian seas, countless pilgrims had gathered for the worship of local sanctities, the abbey's saints reposing deep underground in caverns. Suffice it to say that the monastery gave shelter and food of sort to 40,000 people daily, while those for whom there was not enough room lay at night side by side like logs in the extensive yards and lanes of the abbey. This resulted in a drastic increase in demand that, according to Kuprin, sent the overworked institutions of prostitution to their ruins. The end of Yama was sealed by a soldier's pogrom, followed by a ban by the city authorities. The treatment of Kiev in Kuprin can be characterized in this novel as a combination of several approaches or molds found in the 19th century. On the one hand, it is a thematization and interpretation of the Kievan space in a romantic fashion that revels in the possibilities of demonizing an urban space offered by Kievan past and extended to its present. On the other hand, Kiev in Kuprin shows traces of the 19th century explorations of Ukraine as the imperial self. Hence, languor, leisure, and lust are indivisible from associations with the southern imperial city. Finally, as I have tried to show, the inverted Kievan sacred text plays a couple of pranks on Kuprin, regardless of his good moralistic intentions. And now I would like to get closer to conclusion. Kuprin's novel is a slightly outdated, old-fashioned translation, and it's still available through the network of used bookstores on Amazon.com. The book indeed seems to be a precursor to Viktor Malarik's The Natashas. Kuprin's southern city has changed dramatically, but the problems his novel was aimed at exercising remain. Problems of morality, trafficking, corruption, and the debilitating normalcy of transgression and deviation in an urban environment. With the expansion of the city, Yamskaya Street is not quite close to the center. It's now quite close to the center of the capital and is surrounded by elite multi-story structures for the new Ukrainians. The Palace of Culture Ukraine, after all, is just 5 to 10 minutes walk. City establishments, however, are to be found in the city, yet now many of them occupy a more central location, scattered around the fancier streets, and their ads decorate glossy magazines or pop up on their own will on their screen during a web browsing of Ukrainian media, if not even literature. The productive examination of the Kievan myth will inevitably address texts like Kuprin, and some of them will be uncomfortable and uncomforting. Yet at the same time, the possibility of these disentangling the hypertext of Kiev of various origins and various appropriations with visible and invisible city betwixt, it is there that we are likely to find conditions for inquiry, introspection, and advancement of some truth, naked or vested. Thank you very much.